You're listening to The Startup with Monique Leray, only on LA Talk Radio.
How's it going? It's The Startup with Monique Leray. Welcome. I'm so excited to be here, you guys. What a week. It's Cannes week, guys. But not only is that, this is the week where I'm getting my honorary PhD. It's a little late, so I'm excited to be here in Europe, specifically in Paris. In Cannes and Nice. And speaking of speaking of success, we have Lyndon Haynes, our author, our friend of Paper Trail, joining us. Lyndon, how's it going? Welcome to The Startup.
Hi, Monique. It's really good.
Oh, can't hear you that well.
Very well, thank you.
Let's try that volume again. Lyndon, we love your beautiful smiley face. We just want to make sure we can actually hear you.
Can you hear me?
Let's check that volume. Sam, are we good on volume? Okay, let's see what Sam's saying. Oh, great. Okay, good. That's good, 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 good. Okay, great. Okay, great. Well, I can't, but that's all right. Maybe it's me. All right, Lyndon, keep going. Let's go full screen. Reintroduce yourself to the listeners and viewers and tell them about your beautiful book and who you are.
Hi, my name is Lyndon Haynes. I'm an author from London, and my current book that I have on release is called Paper Trail. It's a crime thriller genre. It's full of deceit, full of intrigue, full of twists and turns. And I'm still, you know, trying to promote it and get it out there to the people who are interested to read it.
Well, welcome back. And I can't hear anything, but I know what Lyndon has said, and he probably told you guys about his book and that they are titles of songs, especially in hip hop. He has an amazing career. He's from London. And he just retired, and because I just saw Lyndon in London, and we did an interview. So it's a little weird that you guys can hear him, I can't hear him. But Lyndon, I'm really excited to have you here. You're in the swag bags. We've got an event tomorrow in Cannes, and I'm very interested to know, how's it going with the book? And when I met with you a few days ago, you already were sketching out the cover for the second book. How do you move so fast? How do you know when it's right? I've heard of writer's block, and I believe it's real. How do you know when that writer's block's cleared and you're actually really in the clear to start?
Yeah, basically, first of all, Paper Trail is going great. I'm trying to get some more readers, and thanks to your show and other stuff that we've done, you know, my audience has gone up a little bit, so I'm getting more sort of reviews and views on the book. So that's great. The second part to the book is going to come out later on this year, probably at the end of summer, early September, hopefully. And yes, I've done sort of like a mock-up cover of how I want it to look. It's not confirmed yet, but it's something that I'm working on. And you was talking about how do I write so fast and so much and with writer's block. So what I do, I tend to give myself a break, like after I've finished a book, and I tend to have like a break of about a month, 2 months, just to clear my head and think about some other ideas that I want to do. But then I really already have it in my head what I want to write for the new book or for the next book or how the story is going to go for the next chapter. So I tend to just write notes all the time and continue with that and then just sketch it out. So, yeah. Yep.
Lyndon, I want you to keep talking. Plug your book on where people can find it. I'm going to exit and come right back due to my sound issues. You carry the show for me, Lyndon. Now you know you can, okay? So keep talking about your book and I'll be right back. Keep going.
All right. If you haven't seen or heard about my book, it's called Paper Trail. I have a copy here. It is available on Amazon. It is available globally online. It's a book, again, about two siblings who are sharing a secret that they work for the same criminal underworld, and they haven't told each other because they're hiding it from each other. And there's a series of plot twists and deceit and betrayal and everything that's thrown into a modern day thriller. It's set in London, and it goes across the world to some other places. It gets taken, you know, to the Middle East and Europe and places like that. So, yeah, I really wanted to write like a commercial sort of contemporary book so I can get some readers from all around the world to enjoy it.
Well, you did a good job, and you're doing a good job with the listeners and viewers around the world now. Thank you for holding down the show. And I got to say, Lyndon, you signed a copy for Benjamin, and he read the whole book on his journey back
already
after meeting you.
He's a quick reader.
I know. He's a quick reader, and also he lost his phone, and that's a whole other journey. He got a new phone since then, but he didn't have anything to do to play with or listen to, so he read Paper Trail on his way home. So
how exciting. What was his verdict, can I ask? Did he enjoy it? Or
he said he loved it, and to tell you, he loved it, and thank you for saving him from boredom. From like 2.5 flights back home.
That's a good time to read. Oh, thank you.
Yes. So talk to me about, you know, I always like to talk about how you're going to encourage the next person, like the author. And I know we've touched on it before, but now that you've had a little bit more time since we first met and you've sold some books and you've just retired and you've got more perspective and you're writing your second book, what is that tactical, practical word that you would want to hear from someone if you were just starting off, right? Let's go full screen. Yeah.
I think you got to have the discipline and two words I'll give you, discipline and determination, because sitting down to write a novel takes time. It's a long process. It can take over a year, it can take 2 years. I tend to write mine within a year because I usually start the sort of pre-production before I even, you know, begin writing. But if I was talking to a new author out there, I would say, you know, have a belief in your idea, in your story, and then just take your time and sit down, be determined and be disciplined, because you will have to put the hours in to really sit in front of your screen and really write it out. And you may have to write maybe more than one draft. You know, you're going to rewrite, you're going to go back and check and edit and rewrite and do another draft. So it does take long, and you'll need to stick with it. So determination and discipline, that's what I would say. But then still stick to your belief of the story that you're going to tell.
Yeah. And I think that's really, really good to prepare folks that it is not that easy, because speaking of AI and, you know, I know, hard left, right? But how are we using AI in our book writing? What do you think is ethical? What do you think is unethical? Because we can write books pretty quick if we used it. And where's the line in your view? Like, okay, I have a concept, I type it into the chat and I just keep typing and it spits out ideas. Is it a refinement tool for you or in your view for writers, or, you know, where's the line when we use that?
You know, that's a good question. You know, Monique, I got asked the other day by somebody, like, would I use AI to write a book, like my own book? And for me, I'm quite old school. I like to come up with the ideas myself and really challenge myself to, you know, complete a story and create the characters and the narrative and everything else that goes into it. But we are fighting a digital world where AI is becoming more and more, you know, prominent in this world. You know, you see it in music now. People are making songs through AI, and I'm sure people will start writing books through AI. But for me, I'm not really totally on board with that yet. I know that some people will do it. It cuts corners, I think, and it kind of like doesn't give you the authentic sort of writer style. It just gives you like a automated style of writing. Who knows, though, in the future, people may enjoy reading stuff like that. But I like the craft of writing. So I'd like to stick to, you know, trying myself to create a story and stuff like that. So,
yeah, I hear you. I wonder what the line will be. I remember taking an MBA course and they gave us the guidelines and they said we could use AI to find, you know, refine our work. But they would be checking it. And you had to list your sources. I mean, you're in academia as well. I don't know how much of that you want to share, but are you seeing that in the work that you do with some of the youth?
Yes, because It's a shortcut, isn't it? It's like I know that in schools and colleges they're not allowed to use AI to, you know, complete exams and stuff like that. So, but they can use it as a tool to maybe create like a draft or something. But how far they go with that, I don't know. But I would encourage, I like to encourage raw talent. You know, I like to bring stuff out of people that they have already in them. And I just think that, you know, if we challenge young people to use their minds and their imagination and their creativity, it's a better tool than using AI. That's my opinion. But
yeah, it's good for like work, like repetitive work things, or refine, or like tell me what this is, or make this, you know, and capture this. I don't know. I like to use it when I want to rest my brain.
Yeah.
A cruise control tool for me.
I think if you're running a business or something and you need to get like a business plan done, or you need to get a draft of a proposal or something like that, it's a very useful tool. I don't disagree with using it in that way. But I think in terms of creation and using your imagination and your brain and challenging yourself to, you know, create something from nothing, you know, I'd like to still think that we're able to use our minds and imagination to kind of create something new.
Okay, that's really good. So let's talk about the second book, Lyndon.
Yes.
Tease us out a little bit here. What do we have going? What can we talk about? What's happening?
I've got a little screenshot here. I don't know if you can see it. Hold on. Let's see.
Okay, let's go full screen, Sam, one more time.
So it's called La Maison d'Alor. This is the follow-up to Paper Trail. And this is, I used AI to do the book cover myself because I knew what I wanted. So I created this. And this is like the prototype at the moment. It's a follow on from Paper Trail. So it does have a couple of the same characters in there. And it's a continuation of 5 years later after what happened in the previous book. So everyone's 5 years older and they've moved on to different things now. But the concept is still the same. There's still themes in it that I used in the previous book, like, you know, the underworld and, you know, the trafficking and stuff like that is all part of it. And again, I used different countries to tell the story as well.
It looks, and I love a Blumhouse horror movie, so it looks scary. I saw it when I was with you in the meeting in London. And I know that you just told us a little bit, but what was the inspiration with the cover? Because it looks like a horror movie, Lyndon.
It does. It does. So the translation is The House of Allure. Okay. So that's a clue there. So it's based around this house that houses a particular dark web website. That's all I'll say. And the person who runs it is part of the underworld, criminal underworld.
Wow.
And it's got a few themes in there, some dark themes, but some good ones as well. But the main characters, Cindy and Dwayne, they're back in it again. And Cindy gets herself into another sort of drama with a friend of hers in New York. And then it all spirals from there. So there's a few tales to tell in this one. Definitely.
Wow. Mm. It's a female John Wick. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, it could be. I'm not going to give away too many secrets.
It could be. All right. Well, Lyndon, it's really great to see you. I know it's late there because it's late over here. I'm so excited about the second tease out. Where can folks buy your book right now? Get that special gift, that summer read.
Every online retailer that you can mention, you know, across the world. So Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Waterstones, Walmart, everything. Just Google it online and it will be there. And you'll see my name in the books.
Really great to see you, friend. And
thank you very much, Monique, for having me again.
Thank
Enjoy the rest of your time and congratulations on your PhD.
Yes, my honorary doctorate. Thank you. Yes, it's happening in Las Vegas. Shout out to Eric Johnson getting that for myself and picking that up for Selwyn Jones while we both are traveling and not there. We're excited and very honored to.
Well done. Well done to you.
Thank you, dear. Thank you. All right. We'll see you soon. All right. Guys, how's my background? I live in the house of White Lotus. Okay. I moved into this little partel and it looks like White Lotus behind me. It's so fun. I'm a little parched. I'm going to grab some water. It's been a journey, you guys. I don't know. I have another chapter. I need to talk to Lyndon about this. I have another chapter of this whole thing with the films. You know, it's one thing to travel around and to network and then market for the films and look for people to want to invest and further distribute the films. But it's another to go back around the world and tell them and talk them into it, you know. And so it's an honor and a pleasure. Thank you to all my sponsors that helped us get here. Sam for his patience with me and my connection and all the things that it takes. But here we are, you know, doing our thing. And I'm excited because our next guest is here, you guys, on the startup. Miss Susan. She was early, everybody. I mean, Miss Susan's looking beautiful and happy. Welcome, Susan. How are you? Welcome to the startup.
Thank you so much, Monique. I am very happy to be here.
Yes, wonderful. I'm happy that you're here. I love your background and your energy. Thank you for dealing with my jet lag and the time difference and all the fun things that come with that. Let's go full screen. I want you to introduce yourself to the listeners and viewers and tell them who you are.
I will. Thank you. Hi, everybody. I am Susan Schmidt Winchester, and I spent almost 37 years in a corporate career. My profession was human resources. My last 16 and a half years, I served as the chief HR officer, one for a Fortune 500 company, the other a Fortune 150 company. So I have spent a lot of time in the corporate world, and I'm very excited to be here. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the book that myself and my co-author Martha Finney wrote, which is called Healing at Work, A Guide to Using Career Conflicts to Overcome Your Past and Build the Future You Deserve. I'm now retired. I retired a couple of years ago from corporate and just having a ball with executive coaching practice and consulting practice and a lot of speaking as much as I can on healing at work.
I like that very much. Congratulations, because you have a lot of material to work with, okay? And you're doing this almost reverse engineering of healing. A lot of people say going into it and healing your child wounds to start your business and to be, you know, successful is the way to go. I like that you're meeting people where they are and taking those experiences from work and doing that. Tell us a little bit more without giving it away.
Sure.
What are we in for? Full screen, Sam.
Well, what I like to say is I'm on a mission to change how people experience their workplaces. Most of us, me included, for many of those years of my career, go into work, we do our very best, but it feels like a place of stress. I know myself, I would say the first 30 years of my career, my success was fueled by my underlying belief that I wasn't good enough. And as a result of that, I constantly felt worried. I would go home every night after work and review what I thought I'd done well, which was never good. Usually it was looking at all the places where I should have done something differently. And it unfortunately for many people, it's like spiraling every single day into a painful pit of suffering. And I think there's a totally different way that we can do this. And that's what Martha and I have done, is we've created a book that, rather than the workplace as a source of stress, it actually can be an incredible place for healing. And my purpose, my life purpose, is to teach self-acceptance to create a more joyful world. And I think healing at work can completely transform how people experience not only their workplaces, but their bosses, their colleagues, and themselves.
Wonderful work here. Thank you for this, because I think this is actually going to help folks who, because we saw, because you probably well researched in this, we saw a lot of quiet quitting post-pandemic, endemic, right? And folks were just like, oh, here's a good off-ramp, and I don't have to explain it. Maybe they couldn't even explain it to themselves. So this is really great. Are you working with corporations and scale-up startups to help their employees kind of avoid quitting and all those things that come with?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I'm working with organizations. I'm working with my executive coaching clients. I have an opportunity to do a lot of keynote speaking all over the world and really teaching people how they can leverage really amplifying human capability in their workplaces. I have an opportunity working with one company right now to do an entire series around healing at work, where we teach the basics, but then also the practices. You know, so it's one thing to hear the concepts about how to heal at work, and it's another to learn the practical tools and applications to help people actually move beyond that place of stress, worry, anxiety, pain. Many of us high achieving people end up turning to unhealthy self-soothing habits because we never learn how to regulate our nervous systems.
Right? She's telling the truth on a Sunday, isn't she?
Well, you know, I just had my 22 years of sobriety because my best friend was Chardonnay for many, many years.
Oh my goodness. Congratulations. Yeah. Yes.
Thank you. Yep. Well, it was definitely a journey, but I see so many people struggling, either overeating, workaholism is an epidemic right now. Anxiety at work is an epidemic. There are all these dynamics. And we both know that as companies and organizations are pressed more and more for operating earnings, et cetera, their earnings release, et cetera, that they need to meet, they're asking people for more and more and more, which just puts the pressure on. And that's why I think it's a perfect time for people to learn about healing at work, learning ways to cope. And actually, one of the key concepts of the book and why I think healing at work is so relevant for so many of us is that it's really grounded on the research that was done many years ago by Kaiser Permanente and the CDC, led by two doctors, Anda and Felipe. And they wanted to understand and study the impact of childhood trauma on health. And they did this survey. They did it in the US initially. It's been replicated in other countries now. But they basically asked at that time 17,000 adults in the US to answer a survey asking if they'd experienced any of what they call the 10 adverse childhood experiences. Okay. And the 10 adverse childhood experiences are significantly traumatic. So it includes things like physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. It includes parents being separated or divorced, addiction in the household, mental illness in the household, a family member being incarcerated, and domestic violence. And when they got the results back, nearly two-thirds of the people they surveyed indicated that they experienced at least one ACE. And when you think about that, two-thirds of the people we're working with are coming from a past that was probably a challenging past, a dysfunctional childhood.
Wow.
And as a result of that, I wish I'd known this, you know, when I started my career, it would have saved a lot of suffering.
Boy. But
what's actually playing out is that when we've experienced an adverse childhood experience, when I took the survey, I scored higher than four adverse childhood experiences.
Well, you were honest on your test. You did not cheat.
No, I was shocked and surprised by it. But the result of growing up in a childhood when you feel a sense of anxiety, when you feel like you're constantly staying hypervigilant because there's something significantly difficult in the family system, what happens when we're little is we literally take away beliefs about ourselves, beliefs about others, particularly authority figures, and we're constantly looking for ways to create safety and predictability in our environment. And so, I mean, I could tell so many stories over all those years of working in the corporate world. I'll use myself as the example. My childhood, and this is not about judging parents or caretakers either, by the way. This is really about understanding that our parents also had their own traumas when they were little.
Okay.
And you see generational trauma being carried out. But for me in particular, my dad was a smart man, but he also was unpredictable with his rage. And it was extremely scary. He was a very big man. And if like the smallest infraction, I remember slamming a screen door one day and it was like the house exploded and he was so angry. And so I learned about myself that it was basically his job to determine my worth and value. And my job was to be as perfect and pleasing as possible. And I believed that, you know, that's what I believed going into my career. When I started my career, I was constantly reading the signs for whether or not there was a threat around anger or rage. And all those patterns that I learned when I was little carried along with me. Yeah. and again, resulted in that, you know, constantly beating myself up, drinking too much, blaming the people around me for triggering me. You know, that's a common thing.
Yeah.
And I call it the unconscious wounded career path. When we're operating in the workplace using an old system and operating code that came from our childhood.
Wow.
And that's what healing at work's all about, is how do you break that pattern? You know, you talked about quiet quitting. That's a pattern. A lot of people take on the pattern of not speaking up and staying quiet. And actually, when you start looking at the nervous system responses, fight, flight, freeze, and fawn, which is pleasing, you start to see people's behaviors playing out in the workplace this way. You see the bullies, those are the fighters. You see the people that are freezing or staying quiet and not speaking up or trying to hide, stay off the radar. You also see the, you know, the people that are fleeing, they're leaving the company because they think it's a miserable whatever, when in fact, they're the ones that may be very much part of the story that they've created about other people. And then the people pleasing, which is, was my, I was very good at that. And it was highly rewarded in the workplace. But again, it takes a significant toll.
Yeah.
So that's basically the opportunity, is for people to become conscious of their past limiting beliefs, beliefs about other people, their patterns, and start learning ways. And again, this is the pragmatic application of how do you actually process when you're upset at work, when someone's upset you, in a way that allows you to calm that nervous system and be able to move forward and take responsibility for your own reactions and beliefs that are often incorrect in our relationship with other people.
Wow. Just kudos, Susan. This is really, really insightful. Thank you for being so vulnerable. And I see that you've done this. And like you said, you're an executive coach and you're on a level of healing and sobriety, or you've already done that. And so, wow, it's really important to understand how this, and also, you know, I was doing a deep dive on myself and I'm like, sometimes folks, due to their upbringing and stuff and such, you're attracted to certain jobs, right? Yep. Some are where they keep you away or distant and emotionally detached from family and friends. And I was looking at that, I'm like, I'm really always on the go. Like reality TV had me on the go.
Right.
And I like the challenge, you know? I mean, have you, in your research, have you found that, that there's a certain makeup on how people choose their careers?
I have not done that kind of research. I think it's a really interesting question that would be definitely something to look at. I do think that we're drawn to experiences that enable us to learn that we don't have to react the way we have always reacted. You know, so if a person tends to find themselves moving far away from their family, it's very likely they were also an individual that experienced some kind of an ACE, and their way of creating safety was to leave and get as far away as way. I can't talk.
I can't either.
You know what I'm saying?
So good. It's
yeah.
Good. Yes. So much good information. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we're all looking for ways to stay safe and to create predictability and whatever it takes. If it means moving away so you have to deal with a certain personality, that can definitely be, I'm sure, motivated by the childhood experiences that one had.
Yeah. That's really, really good insight. I'm loving everything that you're saying. Folks regulating their nervous system and, you know, workplace things. And so I'm sure this helps curb liabilities for the employer when they can help their employees meet themselves. Like meet, a lot of people say HR is for the company and not for them.
Right.
But this sounds like it's a proactive way for a company to avoid mass exodus or liabilities or, you know, other things. Is that where you come in? Are you coming in when companies are having issues with personnel?
Well, the thing to think about is, you know, I'm talking about how we each experience our childhood past and how often that shows up in our child, in our adult reality at work. And so if you take the concepts we've just been talking about and the research, and you take a look at leaders, individuals that are leading teams, leading companies, leading people, if that leader is in an unconscious state relative to his or her beliefs about themselves and others and their coping mechanisms, and they don't know how to regulate their nervous system, when you have unaware leaders who are dysregulated, that can create an entire chaotic environment and culture. And so I think this is incredibly valuable for companies, because this isn't just nice things to do for your people. This is about how do you enhance capability? How do you create an environment where people want to be part of? How do you make sure your leaders understand their own unconscious past and how that may play out and what they can do about that so that they can start to change how they interact with not only their teams, but themselves? And it's a huge opportunity for productivity. It's a huge productivity for retention opportunity, engagement opportunity. Yeah. I mean, all these things are what matters to organizations and their people.
Right. You don't want to see a good C-suite churn.
What's that? What'd you say?
You want a low C-suite churn.
Right. And you know, you've worked with a lot of entrepreneurs in your business and a lot of people in your industry. There are certain people who are highly aware and conscious and regulated, and there are others who are not. And that's at all levels. What I'm saying is the concept of the leader, and there's a great company called Sen Delaney, and they have this concept called the shadow of the leader. Yeah. And what it basically means is that whatever the leader's doing, whatever he or she's doing, everybody in their organization is going to want to do similar things.
Yeah.
So if you have a chaotic, anxious leader, that's going to create that entire environment, which you don't want.
Yes, it comes from the top. Oh my gosh, Susan, let's have you back. This, I could talk to you all.
Thank you.
All night long. You're amazing. You're amazing. You're amazing. I am. Let's plug where we can find your book, and we'll have you back. Where can we get your book, Susan?
Yep, my book with Martha, Healing at Work. You'll notice it because it has two bumper cars facing off. Martha and I call workplace conflict those moments when we get triggered or upset by somebody at work. We call those bumper car moments because it feels like we've just crashed into somebody. And Healing at Work is on Amazon. I'm really happy to say it was just recently recognized as an international bestseller in 5 countries. And, so I'm very proud of it. And I think it can help serve a lot of people. And obviously there's ways to go deeper on this, of course, but that's the highlight.
Congratulations. I'm loving this, Susan. Thank you for doing the work. Thank you for pouring in your personal journey. Congratulations on all your success and sobriety and achievements and becoming the woman that you are today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I can't wait to have you back and see. I'm going to get the book. I'm sure your people, it's in the mail somewhere. I'm sure when I get home, it will be there.
I know it's on its way because I wrote the card to you.
Oh, you're so sweet. Thank you. Yes, I'm going to add it to my beautiful collection. And thank you so much for doing this. You guys, if you need healing at work and you want to just put your finger on what is going on with yourself, what might be going on around you, having information is power. And you don't have to feel powerless. You can give yourself the tools. Get Susan's book. And greetings from the French Riviera. And signing off for the first time, Dr. Monique Larae Stinson from the startup What Will You Start Today. Be well. See you guys soon. Ciao.
You're listening to The Startup with Monique Larae, only on LA Talk Radio.